in the last 3 years. My working assumption is most of those, well, I know we've got the breakdown. Quite a few of those were demolished for one replacements with bigger houses. I'll go back and check, but I think very few of those were demolished in order to build a corner duplex. So again, we've got the ability, we've had it for 15 years to do a corner duplex. So I'm not sure, again, I'm not sure we got it right here, but I don't see the boogeyman of all these houses getting turned into duplexes, given that about every eighth or tenth house has been vulnerable to that all along, and those aren't necessarily the houses that are getting demolished. The one next door to you got demolished, and it was the middle of the block, and it didn't get turned into a duplex. It got turned into a great big house. So, you know, we've got some data here, of what's actually happened over the last ever many years you want to look at. You can go all the way back to the 1989 report if you want, but we've got data about what's happened. Well, and we've got data about how many lots are zoned for duplexes.
You're also part of the BPS proposal is on scale. And so if this were adopted, then the developers would not be constructing the huge homes.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to.
Right.
So, and that wouldn't be as profitable. So we're just thinking that the alternatives, the various, whether they be duplexes, triplexes, or others, would be something they would turn to in order to make a profit. We're talking about making a profit,
right,
one way
course,
or another.
Of course, yeah. And again, I want to read the economic report more closely, but I don't think developers are tearing down houses because they are inherently evil people. I think they're tearing down houses because it's profitable to do so and replace
right.
them with a much bigger house. So the 2,500-foot ceiling, to me, I believe, will be a big damping down factor. Regardless of the contents of that 2,500 square foot building,
that's our hope.
Yeah.
But we're concerned about the middle housing and the housing that not the huge homes that would be coming in because they wouldn't be coming in, but other housing and more demolitions.
Yeah. Thank you,
sir. Can I ask the same question I asked someone else earlier? Which do you think is worse? And you could say they're both bad, but which is worse, knocking down a 1,500-square-foot house and replacing it with one 3,500-square-foot house, or knocking down a 1,500-square-foot house and replacing it with two 1,250-square-foot duplexes?
Well, what we would prefer is that homes not be knocked down.
Right.
And that you would find areas of the city, to the east perhaps, where you would not have to destroy existing homes in order to build new structures.
But if you had to choose, which do you think is worse?
Pardon?
But if you had to choose, which do you think is worse?
Oh, I don't know. I think it would be a very difficult. It's a very difficult question. I think it would be a dilemma.
That's what we got here. Thanks, Al. Appreciate it. Keep it coming. Welcome.
I am David Scholhammer, and I chair the Land Use Committee for the Selwood-Moreland Improvement League, better known as SMILE. Our neighborhood is experiencing phenomenal growth. In 2014, we had about 6,000 housing units in the neighborhood. We presently have 1,233 housing units under development, a 21% increase. Most of this growth is happening in our commercial corridors, and we have 2.8 miles of commercial corridor. Given this context of phenomenal growth in our neighborhood, we believe that there is insufficient justification for the proposed density increase in our single-family zones. We question whether single-family to multifamily conversion is needed to accommodate future growth in our neighborhood. We believe that a better approach would be to estimate the housing demand in our neighborhood and then to determine the ability of existing zoning and infrastructure to accommodate that demand. This should be a holistic approach that considers commercial, multifamily, and single-family zones together. While we oppose the density increase, we support the proposals to limit the scale of houses. One concern we do have is with the R2.5 zone. There, the proposed floor area ratio is 0.7 to 1. This would allow a 3,500-square-foot single-family house to be built on a standard 5,000-square-foot lot. We also have a lot of lots that are just under 5,000 square feet. So we're concerned that this would become the McMansion zone, essentially, in our neighborhood with these oversized houses. We believe that a solution to this would be to establish a maximum floor area ratio of 0.5 to 1 per unit in that zone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. Okay.
Next three are Maria T. Mai, Merrill Reddish, and Allison Marchi. That's 22, 23, and 47 has to leave. And sorry, they'll be followed by Marty Suchek, Jim Peterson, and Gabrielle Hayden, 24, 25, and 26.
Okay. Sorry, I don't remember who's first, but go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mayor Harrells, Commissioners. My name is Maria T. Mai, and I am here to address an issue that I spoke about 20 years ago, and that was during the Southwest Community Comp Plan. What you've heard a lot about is housing types, sizes, and characteristics. What you haven't heard about is the pervious surface areas and loss of pervious surface areas to impervious surface areas. The planning report needs to address the footprint of these pervious surface areas. Across the city, developers are gobbling up small bungalows, and as you said, Mayor Hales, to the tune of 700. What this means is McMansions, duplexes, all these other types of homes that people are talking about are being built, and they're being built out to the lot, maximize the lot line. What is not being considered is the pervious surface areas and the areas that are for open space, big trees for wildlife, urban wildlife habitat. And what we need to do is to consider these pervious surface areas. And I get it. It doesn't pencil out for a developer to buy a small bungalow at $450,000 and build a small house. They need to build something that's going to be $700,000 or more to pencil out. So the cost of impervious surface areas is lost. So what my ask to you is this, is that you charge BES and the Planning Bureau to draft an ordinance that incentivizes developers to subscribe to a 1-to-3 ratio of structure to open space and thus pervious surface areas. So what that looks like is the house is one part of the lot, the other part is three parts, open space and pervious surface areas, and preserving the big trees and open space for children and others just to have open space to play and live. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and City Council members. My name is Meryl Reddish. I'm here on behalf of the Urban Forestry Commission, and since Ted Labby shared the Urban Forestry Commission's recommendation, I will not duplicate that, but I just wanted to go on the record and underscore that providing more flexibility and incentives to developers as part of this project is something that we want to recommend. We're concerned, of course, about the loss of large trees and preserving large trees as part of this project is one of our key goals. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Allison Markey Young, and I'm speaking on behalf of a friend of mine who's unable to make it because of childcare. And I would like to say that I'm speaking on behalf in general of perhaps a younger generation, because there's not a lot of us who have the luxury of attending meetings like this. So this is her letter to you. I'm a 33-year-old native Oregonian who grew up in West Lynn, moved to Portland, and who desires to remain in this community. I have built friendships, have family, have worked to better our community. She spent a year working with low-income students in AmeriCorps. When my husband and I decided to have a child, we began looking for housing options. Our current apartment is so poorly insulated that in the winter, olive oil becomes solid at room temperature. And unless they spend a great deal of money on electricity, they can't keep their home heated properly. As adults, they can brave the cold, but it's not an option now that they have an infant. In the 10 years since my husband and I married and moved into the Southwest Portland neighborhood of Multnomah Village, rent in Portland and the surrounding area has doubled. As a rule of thumb, experts say one should spend 30% of their earnings on housing. My husband and I choose teaching as our profession, and since it requires a master's, their loans make spending 30% unrealistic. When they first looked for housing, discovered that the average cost of rent for one bedroom, and they need two with the baby, was around $1,500 to $1,600, it means that they could not afford to move. Even though her husband's a middle school teacher, she's a substitute teacher, they do not make enough money to afford this kind of rent. They looked at surrounding areas around the city and discovered that it's the same cost everywhere. She hopes you'll take the testimony into consideration today. As a family of three with a teacher's salary combined with a substitute salary, they cannot afford to live in this city. And it's a very real problem with our housing options. So they're writing in support of RIP and greater housing options so that they can stay in their community with a more diverse chance at staying.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. If you want to leave us a letter, she can make copies for us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Next three are Marty Suchek, Jim Peterson, and Gabrielle Hayden. And they'll be followed by 27, 28, and 29, Alan De La Torre, Tony Jordan, and Jim Labby.
Okay, good afternoon. Why don't you go ahead while they're getting settled.
All right. My name is Gabrielle Hayden. I'm a member of the Overlook Neighborhood Association, though I don't speak for them here. I was born in a commune slash house share in Northwest Portland, and I grew up in Boring. And I loved my chickens and pony, but I hated feeling isolated and depending on my parents for rides. I strongly support residential infill and the revision suggested by Portland for Everyone. Neighborhood character is about people first and about building second. When my wife and I purchased our very small, but my own experience offers a perfect case study for why this plan actually supports both elements of preserving neighborhood character. When my wife and I purchased our very small, dilapidated 1924 home, all the other prospective buyers, according to our realtor, were developers planning to scrape and build a McMansion. 2 years and thousands of DIY hours later, our 672-square-foot one-bedroom home is still not worth much more than the land it's built on. Allowing infill development would reward us personally financially for rescuing this small home from demolition by allowing further development on our land. Unlike current rules, it would also do so in a way that would allow another young family to live the Portland dream of a residential neighborhood with chickens and walkability both. It would not house the truly poor, but it would help maintain the livability that has drawn tech startups and other economic vitality to our city, which has trickle-down effects, however incomplete. And it would maintain the neighborhood character in the most essential way possible by keeping both our beautiful old homes and the scrappy DIY spirit of Portland alive.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You could put an ADU on it.
We could, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm here for the Multnomah Neighborhood Association, but I want to say something.
Marty, put your name in the record, please.
Oh, Marty Suchet. I think Carly knew. I want to say something about this hearing that makes me very sad, because the subtext of this hearing reflects the polarization of this election and this country. The people who have I Love Housing choices, I got one of these because I think they're cool. Some of the language is that way. Somebody just said young were the young people. Even the concept report says a certain demographic doesn't like this very flawed plan, what I think, and a very flawed survey, and a small one. What is hard for me is that those of us who don't have buttons and are speaking for our neighborhoods, which Multnomah used to be affordable, is not affordable anymore. We just heard that. We do not oppose middle housing. We have a lot of it. We've had a lot of development of it. We oppose the as appropriate. The man from Beaumont and Whistler said that there was somebody who had several different plans for each neighborhood. That's what should happen. And I really feel insulted by people who say, like the young man who benefits from writing a report and is on the planning commission that passes the report, he said, neighborhood character is code for exclusionary housing. And that's not true, and that's an insult to older people who embrace the millennials that are coming into our neighborhood. What Multnomah has, or did have, it has a lot of diversity. It has neighborhood house, it has a new neighborhood house development for child development, it has a Southwest Community Clinic for low-income folks right in the heart of it. It has Meals on Wheels, and when they came, we tried to encourage them to build to 5 stories so that people could live above that, that they were in a hurry and they didn't quite understand vertical housing then. Multnomah should not have this overlay because this overlay goes over the whole thing. And what it is spot zoning on steroids, as you said in the work session, is social engineering. I am not an old fogey. I'm not a certain demographic. I'm older. I have some wisdom. I behave better than I used to.
You do.
Yes.
Hopefully we all do, Marty. Thank
and
you.
I was a civil rights advocate and an anti-war advocate when I was a youngster. I have a lot in common with these folks.
When that young woman said she was speaking for younger people, I assumed she was saying people 60 and younger.
Okay.
So
Thank you, Commissioner.
I brought my own.
So
my
you
own,
would be.
I brought my own baggage into that conversation. But also, I never used the word social engineering. But I did. I have taken a lot of meetings from people on both sides of this issue. And I have been raising questions about the overlay. Well, I want to understand it better. And I've had people make strong cases on either side, and it's unfortunately a feature of my legal training that I try to understand it and ask questions to test assumptions. But I never said social engineering,
okay.
It does look very broad to me, and it does look like it could be accomplished through another mechanism, like a zoning change. And I want to understand those trade-offs.
Yeah. It shouldn't be just as appropriate. Who says what appropriate is? The Bureau of Planning? Well, sometimes their judgment has some shortcomings.
Can I just say something else about what you said earlier about the tone of the hearing? Maybe it's because we do this so often. There's two features about this hearing that I'll just note. One is that it's a peaceful setting where people are making passionate arguments. And two is, in a city experiencing growing pains, we're getting a sense of big disagreements about how we do certain things. But just from my perspective, Mayor, this is a civil hearing.
Oh, it is too.
I actually have found it extraordinarily substantive, and I'm going to run out of paper soon, in terms of the things people are saying. So I'm sorry you feel put upon by others.
I do not feel put upon. I just see this divide of people who are wearing badges. I love housing choices, and so do I, and the characterization of people loving how their neighborhood looks.
Oh, fair enough, Marty, but okay. Badges and signs are fine, but appreciate your point.
All right,
we
don't want to be a center. We don't even want to be a corridor. We want to be a main street, and we want housing to be specific, as you said.
So, again, back to the three choices of do this, do nothing, do something else. I want to hear from you, not just today, but subsequently.
Okay.
If you just want to drop this, that's one.
No,
choice.
I don't.
Okay. I think parts of this are something that you would support, but we
exactly.
need to hear which parts you like and which parts you,
all right.
you
I'll,
can't
I'll
live
do
with.
That.
Okay.
Thank you.
Actually, there's one question. Ms. Simchak, I know Commissioner Fish doesn't like the term, but isn't all zoning social engineering? Single-family zoning is social engineering, saying we only want people living in single-family
well,
houses?
I'm not saying that. I would just... It's using a chainsaw when a butter knife might work better. It is ham-handed, and you know, you just put it on, and we do have a lot of very good developers, but we have some that are just tearing things down, affordable small units, small housing, bungalows that millennials want, and just maximizing their profit. We are displacing middle income and low-income people for.
That's why we're here. I mean, another thing I guess I want to put into the mix here, and Jim, you can comment on this, and others can as well, that is we're hearing a plea for customizing this to neighbors.
Yes.
Not closed to that, okay, but we got to have something that's administratable.
Right.
So if you
so
tell
semi-customized.
Us, so if you tell us how to, if you tell us we should customize it, give us at least some thoughts about how we could do that. Because, again, the duplex thing has been citywide on R5.
Yeah, and we have maybe a half a dozen corners that have triplexes, and one has an ADU, and it works.
Yeah.
One of them is pretty ugly, but...
So we didn't customize that, and it worked out. So.
Well, I think you had before the housing crisis, you had a lot of seasoned planners who helped some builders do things really well.
We also had a SDC waiver. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Jim Peterson. I'm also from the Multnomah Neighborhood Association. And I'm the point person on some objections to the comprehensive plan, the policies that were adopted June 15th. And we're waiting for the city to put 20,000 pages of documents in order and submit them to the city, or submit them to the state. And at that time, after they get an order, there'll be a notice sent to everybody who testified. And we've hired the services of Evan Fowler, a planner from Eugene, and he's drafted our objections. They're being reviewed by two of the best land use attorneys in the city to make them stronger. And one of our objections is on the middle housing amendment, and we intend to take this all away. And the reason we are is that this, if you look at the yellow overlay, it encompasses the whole neighborhood, all of Multnomah. And that basically zones out all the single-family houses. Right now, they're being demolished at a relatively high rate under the current zoning. And that's what this project was supposed to help prevent. And what's going to happen, what's being proposed, will increase that dramatically. And what's happening, the implementation has been put on a fast track, and the policies have not even been approved by the state. The amount of time and cost of the implementation will not be a factor in the merits of our objections. The original analysis provided by MNA early on in the comp plan process showed that we had a 28% increase in capacity before they added all the bonuses to the mixed-use housing. This capacity was added mainly in the mixed-use zones along Barber Boulevard, and we were notified by the staff that the single-family housing would not be affected. The gross scenario report projects 11,000 housing units will be developed in all of southwest Portland between now and 2035, and Multnomah is supposed to get 11% of that growth. We have more than enough capacity. There's no reason to add this extra capacity. This would be considered market factor. Market factor is some very interesting case law before LUBA was formed.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
We also have Habitat for Humanity houses, which are cool.
Right. Yes,
in the right side.
Yes, you do. So let's do a process check here. I think there are a few people, Carla just alerted me, there are a few people who are going to be unable to come back to our second hearing. Is that right?
Correct.
So we might, if we can, extend the courtesy to let them speak first, and I think we're going to lose a quorum in about 15 minutes. Is that right?
This was originally going to end at 4. We've extended it. You asked to create the flexibility at 4:30. I have to go in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
But that won't. Steve, can you stick around for 15?
I was planning to stay till 5.
That work to you? Okay, so the three of us can stay till 5 and continue hearing to then. So let's do take people that for some reason can't come back at our next hearing, and we'll keep chipping down the list.
And Maureen Anderson, if you want to come on up, she has a small child.
Yes, and then, she does.
Yeah, and then anybody who has signed up and is not able to come back on the 16th.
Yeah, and we'll still try to get to more of you as well. So why don't you just sit in the first rows there, and we'll or if you're not able to sit right away, and we'll get you up here as soon as we can. Go ahead.
And the award is having the youngest presenter today.
Yes,
so.
All right.
All she has to do is put her name in the record, or his name in the record. And just...
Oh, it's in there. Yeah, okay. Commissioners, my name is Maureen Anderson. I live at 924 Northeast 65th Avenue, Unit B in Portland. I work as a night shift nurse at OHSU. This is my son, Barney. He is 2 months old yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm here in support of re-legalizing small housing units as part of the residential infill project. 18 months ago, my now husband and I started looking for a home of our own. We have little time to spare for yard work and no interest in more than 1,000 square feet. More important to us was to live near public transit, affordable groceries, and people we knew. As anyone who's tried to relocate within Portland in the last few years knows, maybe including you, Commissioner Fish, the city has few options for middle-income families who want to prioritize proximity over space. We considered old freestanding homes that were on the edge of our price range and the outskirts of our commute tolerance simply because they were among the few physically small and therefore relatively affordable available at all. Fortunately, backyard cottages are legal in Portland, so instead of buying a home we didn't want, we ended up going in with our former housemates to finance an 800-square-foot ADU in their backyard. Because Portland made our little home legal, we didn't have to bid on a home bigger than we wanted, a bid that might have priced out some other family that truly needed that extra space. I think some people you're hearing from today are under the impression that legalizing duplexes, triplexes, and backyard cottages in more situations would lead to the rapid demolition of freestanding homes. I'm happy to say that our neighborhood proves this is not the case. Much of our corner of North Tabor near the Max has been designated R1, R2, and R2.5 for 20 years, and most of the homes on this land are still freestanding and decades old. The difference is that some are not. We have a mix of duplexes, triplexes, little old detached cottages, and classic bungalows mixed pleasantly together. Some properties turn over and redevelop just like in any city, but most haven't. I'm glad that when one does, it's usually been replaced by two small homes instead of one giant one. And that's the final message I'd leave you with. I hope Barney will grow up in a neighborhood like the ones I grew up in as the daughter of a single mom, those where people of many backgrounds and incomes and ages and educations can live together. That's the nation we desperately need. That's the Portland I love, and that's the Portland that the Residential Infill Project can help preserve. Thank you.
Thank you. For those of us who helped create the ADU option, you, Barney, and your husband are exactly who we had in mind.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello, my name is Jacob Sweet, and I first of all want to thank you guys for allowing me to participate in this process. I'm here to talk about the intersection of affordability and housing choices. Mayor Hales, earlier today, you said that these are two separate issues, and they are, but I think that they are more completely intertwined, right? And I think that this proposal that's on the table is going to do some work to address them. I'm a foreclosure prevention counselor with Hacienda Community Development Corporation, and I work with a variety of people facing financial hardships, medical hardships, and generally life hitting them in the face. And we see a lot of good results. However, we see plenty of bad results as well. And by that, I mean people who either are forced to sell their homes or are foreclosed on. These people don't have a housing choice in this city. By and large, what I see is either they go directly into homelessness or they are displaced outside of Portland. They simply can't afford to rent here once they lose their home. I don't believe that they have a housing choice. On the other side of my organization, we help people to buy homes. This is largely Portland's Hispanic community. These people come to our office and our counselors, of which I'm not one, but I'm speaking on their behalf. The counselors themselves call themselves dream breakers, because when they come in, they're below 80% median income and can't afford to buy within the Portland city limits. So these people as well do not have a housing choice necessarily. Finally, I'm going to talk about myself. I'm currently living in a three-bedroom house with four roommates besides myself. I live in an illegal room in a basement, and this is so that I can afford to live in Portland. This is so that I can do the good work that I do. So what I'm asking of you is that you take a hard look at this proposal as it relates to housing choices and affordability, so that not only the clients I've spoken of, but people such as myself doing good work in the city can afford to continue doing that good work and actually live here.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello. I'm Peggy Moretti. I'm here representing Restore Oregon, and I have submitted written testimony, so I will just summarize a few of my points. Our organization has been tracking residential demolitions for several years, and our analysis reflects, by the way, that for every one unit demolished right now, we're only getting 1.4 new units. So we're not getting much for all the demolition that has been going on around the city. Like you said, there haven't been a bunch of duplexes built for all those demolitions. We're concerned about how I mean, we're, of course, we support affordable housing. Of course, we support choices. But what we're very concerned about is that the morphing of this project into something that's pretty much exclusively about affordability, but with no proof that these proposals are actually going to affect affordability. And that concerns us very much. We think that we have a potential here to do as much harm as good, and we better know which way it's going to go before we enact this thing. There are points we think are fine. They're great. The limited size and scale and massing, adding ADUs, particularly the conversion of existing, interior conversions of existing historic homes. But we feel very strongly that right now there are two big shortfalls in the proposal as it stands. One, there's utterly insufficient incentives to retain existing houses. We can't just do this on a hope and a prayer. Our proposal is that the new development of middle housing be restricted to vacant lots or lots where the existing house is less than 50 years old. That we waive system development fees, but only for projects that retain the existing house. That existing residential structures be allowed greater flexibility for those interior conversions without triggering a whole bunch of commercial building code compliance. And that maybe we allow additional ADUs on properties that are designated historic, since design would be subject to review and we could be more assured of compatibility. The other point we're very concerned about is the lack of any context-specific design standards. What's going to keep our neighborhoods from becoming a dense, cheap mishmash of ugly? Restore Oregon would therefore recommend creating very clear, simple, context-specific design guidelines, such as they're using in Denver and other cities. We challenge the advisability of flag lots because I've never seen one that didn't look really, really weird. And this idea of three-story skinny houses is just too ugly. And I think we need to set an absolute maximum on the FAR. It's good to bonus and all that, but at some point we've got to hit a cap. So I guess overall we think this is a half-baked proposal right now. It's good and it's bad, or it has a potential for good and bad, but we need to really, really make sure we have thought everything through and that in our kind of mad dash towards affordability at all costs, we don't make mistakes that are similar to what was made back in the 1960s when people thought that urban renewal back then was the cure to society's ills. And today we are still mourning the loss of neighborhoods that were destroyed with good intentions back then. So yeah, we need to add density, we need affordable housing, but let's make sure that we are doing this in the right way. And let's make sure that these decisions are based on sound evidence, proven results, examples we can look at, see pictures of, and that we respect our heritage and character of these neighborhoods in the process.
Oh, Peggy, thank you very much. You say you've got written testimony. I haven't seen it yet. That's okay. I will see it. But did you put your recommendations that you just iterated in that testimony, those
yes.
points you were making? Excellent. Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to take a look at that. Thank you very much. Thank you both. Okay, let's take anyone else that's here that will have a difficulty coming back for the next hearing, and then we'll see how many we have left after that. Come on up. Welcome. Go ahead.
All right. Mayor Hales and commissioners, my name is Roberta Yambasu. I am the chair of Elders in Action, the senior advisory council for both Multnomah County and the city. I am concerned about the residential infill project concept report, but for a different reason than most of the people today are. While the report acknowledges that accessible housing is a priority need, it fails to mention accessible housing in the policy proposals. This is a glaring omission, an omission which needs to be corrected. The Portland City Council has the opportunity to establish progressive housing standards for the next generations. As an age-friendly city, Portland needs to ensure that all new housing is both visitable and accessible. We have an aging population that will be an increasingly larger segment of the population every year. People are living longer, and baby boomers are reaching their elder years. We want our citizens to be able to age in place. There is no excuse for not taking the actions that would enable them to do so. We must require all new housing to be accessible. Doing so will make our city a better place to live for all people, not just for those currently needing accessible housing, but for those that will need it in the future. We have to plan for that future. As an example, when I needed to replace my crumbling sidewalk, I made that investment. Instead of replacing the sidewalk, I installed a concrete ramp. I don't need it now, but I might someday. And if I don't, my friends and family might. As a citizen and a consumer, I urge you to make Portland a leader in housing policy and include both affordability and accessibility as requirements for all new housing. Doing so is an investment in a livable Portland for all ages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Tony Jordan. I'm with Portlanders for Parking Reform. Portlanders for Parking Reform supports abundant, diverse, and affordable housing options in every neighborhood. We encourage City Council to support the Residential Info Project's recommended concepts and policies that will create more missing middle housing in every neighborhood in the city. Currently, Portland's housing options are limited and increasingly unaffordable. Many people are forced to move further away from the neighborhoods that are accessible by foot, bike, and transit, and as a result, they become more car dependent. If we want to meet our 2035 transportation and climate goals and build active, healthy, and inclusive communities, we must provide diverse housing options in every neighborhood to allow more access to transportation choices and economic opportunities. In general, we believe that the project concept report is heading in the right direction. Specifically, we strongly support the following recommended concepts. Recommendation 4, allow more housing types in selected areas. Recommendation 7, provide added flexibility for retaining existing houses, although we think that you need to exempt internal conversions from parking requirements, because if you have a big house that you need to subdivide, it's going to be hard to find 3 or 4 parking spaces on that lot. And recommendation 10, revise parking rules for housing on narrow lots citywide. We believe that there are some areas we can do better. Exempt parking requirements is an incentive for affordable housing units. Low-income people are more likely to use transit and not own a car. Infill development that provides affordable housing should be exempt from parking requirements. You should offer parking exemption for tree preservation. We think that the housing choice option should be in all areas of the city, don't exempt some areas, and eliminate parking requirements for all future infill and manage parking with pricing. Bundling parking and housing increases the cost of development and forces people who don't own cars to pay higher housing costs for parking they don't use. The city is already developing better parking management tools, such as residential permits and transportation demand management incentives, to more effectively manage residential parking demand, so we should eliminate those going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Rick Michelson, and I'm another one of the committee members that was on the committee in 1989. So Charlie and I have been working on this for a long, long time.
We sure have.
Was also a RIPSAP member. And while I have issues with many, many things in the report, I'm only going to address one anomaly or problem today. And that's the fact that as developed, this proposal would allow more housing units in the R5 zone than are allowed in the R2 zone. That's an anomaly I think we can't continue to have. In effect, every lot is allowed to have 3 units, triplex on a corner, duplex plus an ADU in the middle, or single family and 2 ADUs in the middle. With ADUs now being up around 800 square feet, that's in effect another 2-bedroom apartment. It's not the small ADU we used to think about. It's a full unit. So we actually could have a 5,200 square foot footprint or in the R5 zone and only be allowed about a 5,000 square foot in the R2 zone. There's a system problem here, that we have some zones that go by FAR and some that don't, but they all need to get coordinated. In effect, what we have in our zoning is an RH that has a 4-to-1 FAR and a 2-to-1 FAR. An R1 zone that has about a 1.1-to-1 FAR, 1,000 square feet units per tenant per lot. An R2 unit that allows a density of about 0.5 FAR. And now we're coming in with this R5 that allows 0.65. which is a higher FAR ratio than both the R2 and the R3. We need to fix that. Listening to a lot of testimony today, it was really like people were talking past each other. And it reminded me a lot about when we were introducing row houses here. There's a whole group of people who have this idea as a wonderful idea and only see the dreams. There's another group of people that sees the same idea and only has their fears. The people who have the dream think it's going to be adding additional units to nice housing and help us preserve housing. The other side thinks that it's really going to lead to increased demolition and fewer scale buildings. I think there's some truth to both of that. And what we need to do as we develop this is find a better way. And one suggestion for today, and I just thought about it today, is if we were to only allow the extra units with an existing houses throughout the city, but suggest and then pick some certain experimental areas where we would allow the proposal as written to go in. We could see whether number one, there's a demand for these additional units without tearing down houses, and number two, what would be the result in the areas where we tear down the houses. I think that's an experiment worth trying.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Rick. Thank you all. Okay, others that want to speak today while we've got time? We still have some, so come on up.
And Alan De La Torre.
Is Alan here? Yes.
There is.
Come on up, please. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Margaret Davis. I live in Northeast Portland, and I'm with United Neighborhoods for Reform. The idea for the residential infill project came out of the United Neighborhoods for Reform demolition development resolution, and that garnered 43 endorsements from neighborhood associations citywide. UNR participated and promoted the work of the residential infill project, partly as a means to reduce demolitions. With disappointment and regret, UNR cannot support this proposal. We feel responsibility to those 43 neighborhood associations and neighbors citywide who oppose demolitions, and we can't in good conscience support something that contemplates demolitions at the scale and rate in the proposal. Hundreds of units of affordable housing, well-built and viable housing, crashed into the landfill in this building boom. Many neighborhoods that used to serve a wide range of residents are now only accessible to the wealthy. Along the way, people in the environment have been dusted with hazardous materials such as lead and asbestos, on the average, almost daily. This proposal does not meet our goals, such as reducing demolitions, and it in fact subverts them, and as you will hear from our speakers throughout this testimony, nor does it meet your goals or the city's. Such destruction is avoidable and unnecessary. Higher density projects are coming in centers and corridors under the newly passed comp plan and at thousands of corner properties citywide. According to the Bureau of Planning, we have twice as much vacant land as we need to meet our density goals until 2035. Inclusionary zoning, too, will help a wider range of people share in these housing opportunities and more equitably distribute the benefits of development. Some people say it is impolitic to participate and then spurn the result. It is also impolitic to stack the composition of the committee against the grassroots charge. It is impolitic to ignore the public cry over demolitions, public outcry, sorry. It is impolitic to say this proposal reduces demolitions when it will accelerate them. There's good news. We care a lot. We can't help but feel invested in these great neighborhoods that we helped make. And we look forward to building a better city with you. But the rezoning of this project, even if it's legally defensible, it promises more the harm than good and further loss of a desirable resource, which is viable, affordable housing.
So I'm going to make the same request of you that I did as others, because you've been so involved in this, and that is three choices: stop now, do nothing, adopt this as is, or are there parts of this that you like? I think so.
I think it's a do nothing thing at this
really?
Point.
So
I'm sorry.
You're fine with the rate of demolition we have now and replacing 1,500 square foot houses with 3,500 square foot houses?
Well, the scale provisions of the proposal actually allow for, I think, buildings as big as or even bigger than are allowed now.
I'm because not aware of that. I thought 2,500 was 2,500. So
they're excluding basements, and they're excluding ADUs and excluding the bonus that's
allowed.
Then maybe
we have the number wrong, but I'm saying I'm not okay with the current rate of demolition and the replacement of small houses with giant ones. I think you and I agree on that. I know we do. So I'm a little mystified, and I appreciated Rick's suggestion that you would say just abandon hope and stop and accept the status quo as good as it gets. I can't accept that.
There are other things that we're doing as a group, and also a lot of individuals are countering at the grassroots level this kind of work. So, for instance, I tried to help tear down Proof My Block, and that's been a very successful effort. It's been neighbor to neighbor. We plan for when we want to sell our houses and move on, making sure that they go to a real family who will live in them and not tear it down. We're attending the open houses of some of these new places that are built and warning about the effects of the hazmat that's probably in the ground. If there's families moving in, they should know that their children shouldn't play in that dirt, that they shouldn't grow vegetables and eat them. So all these things, I think, work to hopefully keep houses standing.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Aaron Parecki. I wanted to give my perspective as a small-time landlord. I currently own a house with a detached ADU, and both units are rented out. I don't personally have the resources to tear down a house and build a giant one in its place, but I do have the resources to remodel a house or subdivide a larger house into a duplex or even build a small detached ADU. As someone who can't afford to build a new house, I'm very excited about the plan because it enables me to be able to create more housing, even just as someone who doesn't necessarily have the resources to build from scratch. So hopefully I'll be able to live in one of those myself as well. I'm excited about these changes.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, City Council. I'm sorry if I did this out of order, but I've got some specs here that I'm going to talk about, and is it okay to give those up?
Sure, right, please. Now? Yeah, or just Carla will. Thank you.
All right, during the course of this conversation.
Just put your name in the record.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, Alan Delatorre, member of the RIPSAC. Wanted to talk to you first and foremost that I live in infill housing in the Overlook neighborhood. My lot used to be an apple orchard that the neighbors were really sad to see go away, but I currently am a contributing member to my community. I own the home with my wife, and we feel like that residential infill opportunity has given us a chance to live in a very important neighborhood, a neighborhood that we've chosen to live in. Just a little bit, too, about why I'm talking today. I don't want to cover all of the details around the residential infill project, but to really focus on the accessibility piece. In my current home, as in a lot of residential infill, I've got to take my daughter out of the stroller. I've got to get the groceries off of my bike in order to get in that house. This is not to mention the aging process and some of the difficulties that I'll talk about. What we're talking about is access to one's home for all ages and all abilities here. Just a little bit on the demographic imperative. We know that the 123,000 people who are going to be added to the city of Portland will include about 40 to 50% of households that have somebody aged 65 and older, and about a quarter of adults in Oregon have a disability. So this is an issue that's important to us, and it's growing in importance. Data are not available for the accessibility of the single-family housing stock in the city of Portland. We don't have that. The Housing Bureau does not have that. It's something that we need, but are just not available to us. And the ADA does not cover single-family homes, so the resulting accessible development that's happening in Portland is not happening in single-family neighborhoods. A couple of things that I just want to throw out there. I support the residential infill project concept report holistically. I really think that there are a lot of good things that are in there, in particular the quarter-mile proximity to services, high-density quality services. When we think about housing costs, we often forget about the housing plus transportation costs. That metric is 45% of our income. We need to consider that here, especially with respect to people who are frail or have a disability. I propose that you consider doing two things with this proposal, that the infill that's a result of this is actually required to be visitable. The concept of visitability has three components: one zero-step entrance, wide halls and doors that will allow you to get a walker, a bike, a wheelchair, anything through there, and then at least a bathroom on the ground floor that somebody could come in and use. Visitability is about your neighbors and your family and everyone else in the community, not just about you. So this is an important thing for just about everyone. And the second proposal is that bonus units, density bonuses that are allowed here, meet a higher standard of accessibility. And I would also extend that, actually, to cottage clusters. I think that that's an opportunity for us to find an innovative solution for housing Portlanders in the future. I do want to put out the caveat that we know topographical concerns and existing structures may require some kind of exemption. So we're not against that idea, but we want to put this out there that by right development as part of this should include accessibility or, at the very minimum, visitability as an outcome of this project.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's very helpful.
Thank you all. Okay, let's take some more folks. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Shall I go? Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Rosemary Sweet, and I will be speaking today in support of the city staff's proposal to marginally increase the amount and type of housing that's permitted in the city's neighborhoods. I'll be sharing my perspective today based on approximately 20 years of work helping to create a Portland that is more just and more ecologically sound. a city that provides everyone with the benefits of a way of life that is both more satisfying and that recognizes the limits of Earth's capacity to support us. In the late 90s, I helped develop the city's green building policies, and my role there was to ensure that ecologically sound housing that was healthier and more durable and more comfortable was available to low-income residents. After that, in my work with Food Policy Council, Farmers Market Fund, and others, I worked on creating access to healthy, locally grown food for everyone. And the city responded to that need and has enacted zoning changes to make healthy food more accessible to all. Portland is now engaged in this thoughtful reconsideration of its zoning in its neighborhoods to create a city that is inclusive and that protects the earth, which, after all, is the only home we have. We must change our single-family zones. This proposal will allow the construction of smaller homes, slightly more numerous homes, houses that use fewer resources, and that support walkable neighborhoods and local businesses. Most importantly, they offer a wider range of housing options for people who prefer smaller homes, who are living singly or as a couple, who cannot afford a detached house, and who do not want to consume more than their share of materials and energy. I consider this proposal quite modest. It offers only incremental growth in the neighborhoods. We are not talking about large apartment complexes in the middle of residential areas. And it's growth that's respectful of the neighborhood's character. While the changes are necessary for our future, they also look respectfully to our past, to a time before McMansions came into vogue, a time when duplexes and cottage clusters fit comfortably throughout the city, allowing people housing choices. On a personal note, and I'll stop there, I now live in a duplex, and in my 40s, I lived in a house with an internal conversion to a second-floor apartment. These homes have been a wonderful source for me of comfort and enjoyment. They fit very nicely within the neighborhoods they were in, and I would just like to see other people have the option to live in those kinds of homes in this city. Thank you.
Thank you. Much. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Garrett Downen. I am a native Oregonian and Montevilla resident. Thank you for this opportunity and for working to address the housing affordability crisis. I'll keep this quick and out of respect for your request, Mayor Hales, because a number of the points that I was intending on making were made by previous testimony. But I did want to add my voice and experience in support of this infill project and testify to the need for mid-level housing. When I was house hunting myself in 2013, it was more of an endeavor than I expected. I toured 60 different homes over the course of a couple months, put in 7 different offers, 6 of which were above asking, and it needed to stretch my initial budget by 30%. But with Portland leading the country in the rate of housing price increases, that's not too bad compared to what I'm seeing people experience now 3.5 years later. And I don't pretend that experience was a hardship compared to the experience of the many who were fighting to keep a roof over their heads. But it felt rough at the time, and I worry about the ripple effects of that shortage to people less privileged than I and my peers. In regards to those peers, I'm seeing many young professionals in their late 20s and 30s, folks who are some of the most impactful and engaged people in Portland who work in nonprofits, in government, at B corporations. Really struggle with finding a place here right now. They are, despite their privileges, I hear them pining over the idea of actually buying a home here at some point. They would love the opportunity to buy or rent in a long-term fashion a part of a duplex, triplex, or what I now learned today are called cottage clusters. I've heard peers dreaming of that as a wonderful living environment. Would love to see more of that. So would they, and they're feeling priced out. So in summary, I support this direction and the revision suggested by Portland from Everyone. It feels like a well-reasoned, balanced, and oh-so-necessary approach to adding modestly priced units.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, commissioners. My name is David Sweet, and I was pleased to serve on the RIPSAC, representing Central Northeast Neighbors Coalition. I want to commend BPS staff for creating an excellent process, which resulted in a proposal that will preserve the integrity of our neighborhoods while providing greater housing choice and affordability. I bought my first house in Portland in 1978. I was 4 years out of college and 2 years on the job as a city field representative. That's how things were in Portland four decades ago. Today, no city field rep can afford to buy that house or any house in that neighborhood, or likely rent there either. Like others of my generation, I got my place on the home ownership escalator. And because I was able to buy a house then, I get to be a homeowner for the rest of my life. My adult children are not so fortunate. Like many millennials, they struggle to afford to stay in the city where they grew up. Not all the houses in my old neighborhood are owned by wealthy people. But when those houses turn over, they will be bought by wealthy people who alone can afford them. And that neighborhood and all of our other close-in neighborhoods will lose the economic and ethnic diversity that has characterized Portland for the 50 years that I've lived here. We will join the national trend toward economic segregation. It does not have to happen that way. The residential infill proposal offers us the opportunity for housing choice in Portland's great neighborhoods, while keeping the scale of new development consistent with existing houses. It will re-legalize the development of smaller, more energy efficient, and more affordable housing. It will offer options for middle-income families that are not currently available. It will allow school teachers, first responders, and shop owners the opportunity to live in the neighborhoods they serve. It will allow young families to step onto that home ownership escalator. It will offer older adults the opportunity to age in community while they downsize. In the late 1980s, I helped work on the Albina Community Plan, and along with that effort, the city created the A Overlay Zone, which legalized accessory dwelling units in some selected areas, a modest yet important step forward. Like the current proposal, that one created some concerned reactions about the loss of integrity of single-family neighborhoods. Yet just a few years later, the idea had won such broad acceptance that ADUs were simply allowed as a matter of right in all single-family areas. The residential infill proposal is similar, a modest yet important step forward. And like the A overlay before it, it will allow incremental, low-impact changes that move us toward equity and inclusivity. And like the OA overlay, I feel confident that these changes will receive broad acceptance and will ultimately be applied to all of our single-family neighborhoods.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank you and all the members of the committee for the huge amount of time that you put into this, and as well as all the other great testimony we've had here today. Unfortunately, I think we do have to stop now because we're going to lose a quorum. And I know there's some of you who've been waiting very patiently to speak. I'm going to put you first on the sign-up sheet for our continued hearing. So we'll make sure that you don't have to wait that long again. Thank you three very much.
And then we do need to, I think, act on them. Next time. We will read everything that is sent in to us, and if you could just put in the subject line, was not able to speak on the first hearing, that would, I'll make sure that I look for it carefully. Thank you.
And we do need to act on a motion, which I am looking for the verbiage for back in my pile, unless one of you has it handy. Let me see if I can find it. To allow us to deviate from the rules in order to have an evening hearing in addition to our afternoon hearing on the 16th. Is that good enough?
Oh, right.
There's the language.
Thank
you, Rachel. Rachel on the spot. I move to waive the 2-week notice to have a 6 p.m. session to extend the hearing on the residential infill project from 6 to 8 p.m. on November 16th. Is there a second? Okay, any discussion? Let's take a vote.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, so there'll be two hearings on the 16th at 2 p.m., which is when we'll, by the way, if you're signed up and you want to come back, you can sign up for either 2 p.m. or 6 p.m., and we'll put you first in either queue. So does that make sense? So we're going to have a hearing at 2, and we're going to recess for dinner, and we're going to resume at 6. So if you are here today and you want to come back and speak, you can sign up for 2 p.m. or at 6 p.m., see Rachel or Carla to facilitate that. And again, thanks for your patience in not being heard today.
I think we just need to make it clear that this hearing is continued.
Yes,
so
it
if
is
you
continued.
Did get to speak today, you don't get to sign up and testify again next week.
Yeah, we are continuing the hearing to hear more testimony. And we want to ask people to continue to send written ideas into us so that when we get to the council discussion phase, we'll have not only heard testimony but had a chance to digest all this great material that people are providing. Thank you very much, and we are recessed till tomorrow at 2 p.m.